You're listening to the Faces of Armenia podcast.
Hello, friends of Faces of Armenia. Today, it's our pleasure to have Jenny Paturian, an associate professor of political science and international relations at the American University of Armenia. And we are here to talk about the Nagorno-Karabakh crisis. But to kick things off, maybe, Jenny, if you could tell us a little bit about your background, where you come from, what you do.
Certainly, and thanks for having me here. So, yeah, I was born in 1977 in Soviet Union at the time, in Soviet Republic of Armenia. So sometimes people think I'm a foreigner in Armenia, but I'm not. I'm a local Armenian, born and grew up in Armenia, old enough to remember the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and what came after. I have spent a total of 12 years at various universities, first at Yerevan State University, then at the American University of Armenia, and then actually 5 more years in Germany at Jacobs University Bremen, getting my PhD in political science. And after that, I returned to my homeland, to Armenia, and got an offer to teach at AUA after a couple of years, not immediately. But since 2011, I've been teaching at the American University of Armenia at the very department where I got my master's some years ago, the political science and international affairs. And I also do a little bit of research as much as I can, given the teaching load. So yeah, most of my research is on civil society in Armenia and kind of democratization processes.
So maybe a quick follow up. So what initially drew you to political science?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I studied philosophy at Yerevan State, and even that was not my choice. We had a very stupid admission system at the time, and you would kind of land in a place that you might not want initially. But it was worth it. And once that was done, I knew I wanted to change my field. I initially wanted to be a sociologist. So studying societies and how they operate was always my interest. And I kind of looked around, and the choice was to go abroad or to try American University in Armenia. My father is also an alum, and he told me, it's a great university, you should study there. And I looked at it. There was no sociology, but there was political science. And I thought, close enough. Why don't I give it a try? And I, from the first class, fell in love with political science. I think it's an underrated discipline. People think it's about corrupt politicians. It's not. It is what I wanted to study. It's about how societies operate, with an emphasis on certain things as compared to sociology. And frankly, what I've been doing is a border between political science and sociology.
And I would even hypothesize that political science is the key to prosperity.
I would think so, yeah. At least we need political science in addition to economics and sociology and then things like that. I think that the overemphasis on economics and businesses is incredibly dangerous and quite misleading. So we need political scientists in the mix if we want to have prosperity.
And so for the viewer to get a better picture of you, could you maybe with one or two words describe your current research that you're conducting?
Yes, I can. I actually, if not for these grim times, I would have been very happy because we have spent about 4 years, actually. We had a grant from the Swiss organization, the Academic Swiss Focus, to study Armenian civil society. And for those who don't know what civil society is, it's a sphere sort of between the private life and the government, so to speak, where people voluntarily come together to do things for the greater good and not for profit. So shortcuts for civil society are NGOs, non-governmental organizations, social movements, but also grassroots movements, volunteering, communities, singing choirs, clubs, all kinds of things. when people step out of their private life and they do something together and they don't do it for profit, but for some kind of thing they believe in, that's the area that we call civil society. So we have 4 years worth of research where we started by looking at NGOs in Armenia, kind of like formal structures, and shifted to looking at activist campaigns, such as people who, you know, following Armenia might remember the Electric Yerevan movement against electricity price hikes. Before that, there was a pension reform movement. So at those times, we were very actively doing field research. And that work is actually just been accepted for publication as a book. It took me years to put it into a book, but that book has been accepted for publication in Springer. And another book that has actually come out is a book on Velvet Revolution in Armenia. It's an edited volume and I have a book chapter there. So those kinds of things, social movements, political movements, volunteering campaigns.
So it is Armenian civil society, colon, old problems, new energy after two decades of independence by Yevgenia Paturian and Valentina Gevorgian.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's not my solo work. I had a wonderful co-author who helped me a lot. So this would have never happened without her.
As we all know, the Nagorno-Karabakh crisis is to a great concern of all of us. People, human beings are dying. Armenia is being attacked and invaded. But before we dwell on the details, maybe if you could also provide us with an account of the history of the conflict and what led to the events of like 3 days ago.
At the beginning, to answer your question, what has happened? Because what is happening takes such a task, is so tasking on people's minds that they're bogged with information. And things like your own publication suddenly become so much less important.
No, like I, over the last few days, I spoke to a number of friends and colleagues in Armenia, and most of them told me that when you're walking through like the cities such as Yerevan, you can see it in people's eyes that all of them are in a way shocked to their bones. And like you can literally taste the sadness, the concern in people's faces.
And my reaction when I heard that there's a war going on was like, really? All right, so now I've posted also a link to the book by Lawrence Brewers and Anna Ohanian. It's an edited volume, and the book is called Armenia's Velvet Revolution, Authoritarian Decline and Civil Resistance in a Multipolar World. And I have a chapter there on civil society. I think it's just called Armenian Civil Society. I would highly recommend the book. I think it's the Lawrence Brewers and Anna Ohanian's book.
And I
think it's a great read.
That's so interesting. So 2018, everybody felt, okay, now all of Armenia is on a fast track growth, on a trajectory towards development, peace and prosperity. Anything seemed possible. And just 2 years later, and I'm also reading a lot, I was very surprised just by the pace of escalation. It's been always tensions, but the pace and intensity is, I believe, unprecedented.
Yes, so let's get to your question of what is happening. Mm-hmm. What is happening is a war. And I do know that international community news sources are using all kinds of words like escalation, flare up, and these words are just, I think we should stare the reality in the eyes and we should call it what it is. It is a war, a full-blown war, which, you know, from, and I'm not a military expert, but from what I know, the line of contact between Armenians and Azerbaijanis, both in Nagorno-Karabakh and in the Armenian side of the border, is one of the most fortified borders in the world.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to having all the ugly modern warfare things like the drones and stuff like that, the It also has the old Second World War style trenches and trench combat, and that just makes it so, the clash is along the entire border. It's incredibly intense. All kind of things are being used, artillery, a plane was downed the other day, helicopters, heavy bombardment, tanks. It looks, some of the conics look like a Second World War tank. It just looks very, very, and it's very intense and very deadly. It's a deadly combat. Mm. And again, to say that it has escalated quickly, technically you're right, but why did it escalate so quickly? Because it was planned as such. It was planned as a full scale, no Armenian doubts that. I mean, of course, I'm an Armenian and maybe I have my own point of view. And the only news sources I'm following are the Armenian news sources because we are worried about misinformation and lies. But it looks like to us that it has been a planned attack that started simultaneously on the entire line of combat. So it's not like it's a flare-up, people shot at each other and then it escalated. It started as a frontal, full-blown attack.
But so what wonders me, if I may briefly interrupt you, doesn't Armenia have intelligence like satellite images which could potentially see Azeri troops moving? So that there could be sort of a preemptive, a prepared strike, because what we've seen now, just yesterday, I think they count 200 injuries on the Armenian side, a full airplane shot down. So it's just incredible how things like turned into a full-blown war.
Well, I don't think I have an answer to this question. This would be interesting to pose. And I'm sure once the things settle down, Armenian people in Armenia will start asking those questions. But I don't know. I don't have a feeling that Armenians were unprepared.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that perhaps exactly because the attack came immediately on the entire front line, but the front line held. Yeah, we did not, you know, there were talks about minor like resets and recaptures, but they did not move back. And so that means that the defenses stood. And so was there information? I think there was, and I think there is. And I think that's one of the big concerns of the leadership, because from day one, from morning on Sunday, they said something which can be translated from Armenian as life and death battle, life and death war. And that's not what it is. Basically mortal combat. And they were very worried precisely because they have information of Turkish troops being stationed, I think, in Nakhichevan, because they were there for military training and they're still there. And it's they are worried about Turkey getting involved beyond what it's already involved. I think downing of the plane came as a surprise. They didn't think Turkey is going to be that bold because the plane was shot by the Turkish plane. So I think that's what they're trying to estimate, whether the Turkey will get even more involved, less involved. So there is the border, as I said, it's one of the most fortified borders maybe in the world. And so the troops were probably already there amassing, and there was some military exercise that was used as a pretext. So even if you know they're coming, what do you do? Like, what do you do? Do you start shooting at them? Certainly not. That's what... Yeah, so I it's a good question. It is a good question that I think will be discussed in Armenia once this is over. But yeah, as I said, I don't have a feeling that Armenian side was caught by surprise and didn't know what to do. I have a feeling that they, I mean, on a larger scale, we all know it could happen anytime. After the April war, the sense that another war can start any day, was kind of in the air. People get used to it, they live with it, but when it starts, it starts. As I said, when I heard it, my reaction was, again, like, another war again. So yeah. Right. So yeah, that's very sad and tragic, but it is what it is.
And then maybe to help everybody, like to level the understanding, can you drop one or two words, doesn't need to be long, of the history of the conflict, just that we are level here?
Yes, the history of the conflict. And I don't want to go too much back in history, to be honest, but I want to share a story from my childhood because I think it is important. And it's not very scientific. It's very unscientific. But I think it's important. So when I was a kid, 1988, pogroms happened in Sumgayit, which is a town in Azerbaijan. It's not in Kabul. But there are a lot of Armenian people. This is when I first heard. So before that, going back, 1987, Nagorno-Karabakh is an autonomous region within the Azerbaijani Soviet Republic, populated mostly by Armenians. Soviet Union is going for this Gorbachev, perestroika, glasnost, openness discussions. And the Armenian local government in Nagorno-Karabakh applies to Moscow with a request to be transferred from being part of Azerbaijan to being part of Armenia. And this is legal according to the Soviet constitution. And there was this feeling that maybe this is the time to do it. I don't want to go more back in history. Why would they even want to do it? Why is it populated by Armenians? Why is it part of Azerbaijan? Let's just take 87. So there's this bureaucratic official request. I don't think they got a reply, and I might be wrong there. But at some point, they again, according to the letter of the Soviet law, they convey a meeting of the local government, sort of the equivalent of the local parliament. They vote on this decision that they want to be transferred to Armenia, and they raise an Armenian flag on the local government building. After that, we hear about the pogroms in Sumgayit. And, you know, I'm a kid, and I can sense the fear, and I can't explain. How does an 11-year-old child sense the fear? But I sensed it, and my fear was the Turks are coming. And it's completely irrational. But at that point, and every time I go back in history and remember that thing, I realize that I do believe in genetic memory. I do believe in collective memory. And the collective trauma that can pass on from generation to generation. And many people, not just me, at those times thought about the 1915 of the genocide of the Armenian population and had that fear. And in Armenian mentality, whether this is right or wrong is a different question. But in the Armenian mentality, Azeris are almost equated to Turks. They are considered to be the same people. And so that pogrom just resonated with the Armenian people in a horrible way of like, this is 1915. These are the Turks again coming to try and kill and rape and burn and whatnot. And that's, you know, history. So, yeah, and that's the history of the conflict. And from then things got only worse. There were more pogroms. There were refugees fleeing from both sides. The Azerbaijanis have to leave Armenia because they were being bullied and threatened and attacked. It was not pretty, it was ugly. But also, pretty much everyone from Azerbaijan had to flee. So, massive refugee. And then in the Karabakh itself, the conflict escalated into a full blown war. Soviet Union fell apart. Whatever tanks they left on both sides, the two armies grabbed and it just blew up.
So, if I may analyze your observation, it implies that Armenia, the collective memory of Armenians, associate like land capture with the genocide. Like if, so say, they lose any land of Karabakh, this is equivalent to another genocide. This is equivalent to leaving the concept of Armenia, to destroying the concept of Armenia.
Yes, there is a very strong sense of not again, and not a centimeter of land, no more, never again. It's a very, very strong sentiment. And again, from Sunday onwards, they started talking that this is not just a flare-up on the border. This is Turkey and Azerbaijan trying to finish what they started in 1950. Now, again, I want to emphasize, I'm not saying this is the objective reality.
Mm-hmm.
I am saying this is the subjective emotional perception of the people, like, not again, no way, they're not coming, we're not letting this happen. Right? So it is very, yeah, it goes back into a trauma that is old, but very deep, and shared. And that's why Armenians almost don't even have to talk to each other. They understand what's happening. They interpret what's happening
mm-hmm.
in a very similar way. So yeah, it's that kind of tension. It's that kind of tension and anger and grim attitude of like, as I said, people call it the mortal combat. They call it the, we have to stop them once and for all. Those kinds of things. Yeah.
So let's fast forward to the conflict. You're based in Armenia, you follow the news, you're right, so to speak, you have a first-hand experience. Can you share with us, according to your understanding, what has and what has not happened, and what is the current status quo? How did the last 3 days develop?
What has happened in terms of what, since Sunday, what has happened?
Yes, like the escalation of the conflict. Like, when did who attacked whom? Where on the border were transgressions? How did it happen that the jet was shut down? I'm just asking this question because all over the world we have The Guardian, BBC, Fox News, and Deutsche Welle reporting on the situation. And as I've been following various news sources, there is not a clear voice. So, which just complicates the understanding, and we would really appreciate your perspective, your understanding of what actually, what's the current status quo, and what happened until that status quo right now.
Yeah. So, what happened is on Sunday, I think 6:50 in the morning. We received the news a bit later, but the news is at 7 a.m. on Sunday, the Azerbaijani military went into a full-scale simultaneous offense along the entire, what they call the line of contact, which is pretty much the border between Karabakh and Azerbaijan. So that border was, all of it was attacked, not like north or east, all of it, the entire thing. The Azerbaijani sources, to the best of my knowledge, say that they responded to a shelling from Armenia, and to which Armenians, of course, ask, how comes the response was so immediate, so coordinated, with the Turkish and Azerbaijani journalists on site reporting from this supposed counteroffensive? And an interesting nuance, Azerbaijan has shut down every social media except Twitter within its own country. And from what I know, they're not letting in international journalists. So that is also an interesting fast response to supposedly the Armenians showing. So for us, there is no doubt in our minds that this was prepared, this was planned. By now, there's also news about the Syrian mercenaries. They have been brought into Azerbaijan ahead of time, prepared to fight, and so on. So there is not a single Armenian would doubt that this is not. It was a planned offensive that started simultaneously along the entire contact. On Monday, they also shelled the Armenian territory of the Vartemis region, but that is the only incident so far that they actually shelled the Armenian territory. And from the start, they actually targeted the civilian settlements as well. The first two victims we heard about was on Sunday morning in Martakert, which is a town in Artsakh, in Nagorno-Karabakh. And the two victims were an elderly woman and a 9-year-old girl. And they died because of the Azerbaijani shelling. So civilian, Stepanakert was targeted right from the start. and they still do. So the villages and settlements in Artsakh are still being shelled. People are being asked to stay indoors or stay in bomb shelters and things like that. That the plane, I am not entirely sure, honestly, what happened. My understanding is when they were, because they're using artillery to shell the territories, but they're also using the drones, the military drones. And so my understanding is that the Armenian plane flew into the air to shoot the drone, mm-hmm. and the Turkish plane intercepted the Armenian plane. That is, from what I understand, is what happened. And that was over the Armenian territory of the Republic of Armenia rather than Artsakh, because we also have borders and we're a tiny place here, we're all next to each other. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened. And yeah, as I said, the Armenian defenses held. I think that was the plan. I mean, Aliyev made, there's no lack of statements from Aliyev saying that we're just going to recapture the land. This is the solution. And that we have to depopulate it, we have to get rid of Armenians, we can blow up the Armenian atomic power plant station and idiotic things like that. So that's, I think their plan was sort of like a blitzkrieg, a massive, mm-hmm. heavy attack that would break the Armenian defenses. And again, because it's such a tiny line, right? It's such a tiny land, theoretically you could overrun. If you break the defenses, you can overrun it. And so then that's it. That's the solution to the Karabakh problem. They just regain and rearm. And that didn't work. And our defenses continue to hold. And the battles just continue to rage.
So if I'm correctly informed, Karabakh has a land mass of 1,700 square kilometers. So which makes me wonder, it's, while obviously in a country comparison context, not large, but still huge. So how does Armenia defend themselves? Is it mostly like troops on the ground? Are there jets? Is there air infantry? What was their strategy to protect themselves at such a large scale? I would really want to say.
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, again, by the way, the author of the book, that the edited volume that I've promoted, Lawrence Burrs, I think he's a good expert also on those kinds of things. I quote him when I say it's one of the most fortified lines of contact. But if you remember Armenia borders on Turkey, and Turkey is unfortunately a NATO member. And so I see fortified closed borders. I've seen them since I was a kid. And it's that kind of fortification, you know, with trenches, with fire positions, with barbed wires, and with neutral zone in between. All of that is there. In addition to, heavy artillery position behind the lines and the intercepting the air defense missiles and all kinds of things. In addition to that, to lighten the mood a little bit, if you go to Karabakh, you will sometimes see that there is like nets that are hanging between the valley sites, because it's a very mountainous region. Mm-hmm. It's literally like a one line and then a few lines hanging down. And these are for planes, because planes have to fly at a certain altitude. And in the past, during the first Karabakh War in 1993-94, some planes apparently could fly through these mountain valleys, and now they have these like nets that catch those planes. But the drones are now the new addition, and those drones do fly, and then Armenian forces somehow hit them from the ground with these, I don't know, what are they called in English? This air defense systems, I guess that's what they're called.
Yeah.
And we get a lot of this footage of them saying how they. Showing how they down a drone and another drone. So human factor, I think, plays a huge role there. But just being technically equipped, but also prepared, that our soldiers are prepared to deal with this and shoot down the drones and shoot down the helicopters and intercept these attempts at flying over. And that's why planes, that's so scary, right? Because, if they do want to shoot the atomic power plant, I think it's stupid, because their own region is going to get radioactive them, but I think it's the air defenses that really down this supply of them.
Oh God! Now it's really concerning because I think it's a life and death issue. But what are your perspectives on if the war escalates even more? What is the worst that can happen? Is there an end game? Would Armenia receive support? Do you think?
I think it won't.
That Armenia could be overrun by Azerbaijan. Now I'm talking not just Karabakh, but Armenia itself, and the world, the international community would just look and say, "Oh, I'm sorry," quote unquote.
Yeah, it's a good question. First, I want to start by saying I don't think it can escalate any further. I think it's a full peak escalation. I think both sides have thrown into the battle everything they have. And as, men die, more men will be drafted. Both countries have full mobilization. Well, Armenia has full mobilization. I think Azerbaijan has partial mobilization. And they're throwing everything they've got at each other. So it is as escalated. What it could also happen is, of course, if Turkey moves in openly, if they move in, that would be escalation. Can it happen? Yes, it can happen. And that is why from Sunday morning, our leadership and people have been talking about it. And what makes me worried is that both sides seem to be calling this the last war. Like, this is the war that's going to end the conflict. So on the Armenian side, they recently said, the president of Artsakh said, "We're not going to ask for a ceasefire. We are going to force a ceasefire." And so there are several scenarios. One is the most grim scenario, if Armenia is overrun, if our strength is depleted. I don't think anyone's going to. Maybe Russia will step in because of the agreement that we have and the Russian base in Armenia. Maybe that's the Russians' game. Maybe they want to draw Turkey into this conflict and then step in. Who knows? But international community will not help. They're doing the same thing they've always done. Both sides will stop escalation, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, okay, you can keep saying that. So yes, it's a scenario. And I wanna say something that's gonna upset some white Americans, but I don't really care. If you wanna understand Armenians now, you have to look at their communities. These people could not be subdued. They could not be subdued. They would, for nothing, they would give up their dream of living free on their ancestors' land in the way they want. As a result, the colonial powers and later on the American government had to do, or not had to, did all kinds of ugly things, basically genocidal practices, up until very recently. Up until 1970s, there were forced sterilization, introduction of alcohol into these communities, very, very early. And they're still not subdued. And they're still there, and they still have their dream. They've diminished dramatically, but they still have their dream. And they still resist. And that's Armenians for you. You mentioned it yourself, that the land is now connected to something else. It's not just the land. It's kind of almost like a spiritual thing of land equals freedom equals ability to exist on the land of our ancestors. And that's what we're defending. It's not square kilometers we're defending. We're defending our sovereign right to live on our land. And I think just like the American Indian, we'll go down fighting, but we will not be subdued. And yes, and in that sense, when Armenians say we will win. Because if we don't win, we don't exist any longer and we don't care. The world will lose a beautiful Armenia. But it's not, no one's gonna stop fighting. So that's one very grim scenario. I don't think it's gonna happen, frankly. I trust my people. I know, again, thanks to Turkey's stupidity of 1915. I hope I don't offend anyone, because the genocide was, of course, a tragedy and a horrible crime against humanity, but it was also, frankly, a stupidity. They made us into unbending warriors because of that. And we're not, Armenians at the moment, the mood is very green, but very bitter. So it's kind of like, you know, steel. And that's one scenario. The other scenario is that we will, as our, you know, leadership says, we will force the Azerbaijanis to a ceasefire because their losses are going to be so horrible. Our losses are also going to be horrible. But Armenians are prepared to pay any price, including complete end, right? And so at some point, that's the history of the first Karabakh War. At some point, Azerbaijan started losing big, and they lost chunks of territory that became the buffer zone around Artsakh, and they were forced to a ceasefire. And so that's the hope and the strategy of the Armenian leadership now, cause as much damage to really force a ceasefire. What also kind of worries me is that if in 2016, they were talking about defending our land, now they're talking about teaching an Azerbaijan a lesson that is so painful that they won't do it again. And you can think Armenians are warmongering, but it's not that. It's just an understanding of, okay, we fought until 1994. Ceasefire held more or less, shooting people, dying on borders. But status quo was kind of okay for us, frankly. Then the 4-day April War of 2016 came, 100 people lost their lives. Okay, we repelled an attack. Now we have this one. So what's the guarantee that 4 years down the road, if we repel this attack, there won't be another one? And that's why some people say to make that kind of guarantee, we have to break Azerbaijan's back for good. And I don't know what that means. Maybe that means Aliyev is overthrown and Azerbaijan finally becomes a democracy. That would be my wish. That would be my wish, that Aliyev's regime is, because it's Aliyev, it's not the Azerbaijani people. It's not, and these people are dying, and that they don't deserve to die. They deserve to leave as well. And that's my hope, that this war will cost Aliyev his presidency, and that the Azerbaijani people will use this opportunity to get rid of him. And hopefully there is a more reasonable leadership. But that hope, you know, historically could also go the other way. Even if Aliyev is gone, the next president might be even more radical, even more nationalist. So that's kind of really scary. Maybe that's where the international community needs to stand. That if there is a meaningful change in Azerbaijan, that they help the Azerbaijani society to democratize. And once we have a democratic partner on the other side, that's when we can sit down. This guy, it's kind of unreasonable. How do you talk to someone who threatens to blow up a power plant station? And you talk about what? So, and then of course, a third scenario is that this goes on and on and on and on until both parties are so weary that, yeah, we are back to where we were without major moves, without an ability to change anything substantially, but we just both bleed to a point where we can't fight anymore. And whatever the demarcation line is at that point, that's where it stops. And that's when, you know, so that's, but that won't happen soon. That won't happen soon. I hope there is no protracted war, but it might be.
So I can only say you brought up a number of very relevant, up-to-date points to the discussion. And so first I wanted to point out that I think it's very important to also name and discuss the worst possible scenario at stake. Because only when you know what could happen, if you are aware of it, you can find solution. It's never good to start into a negotiation with rose-colored glasses. And so what I wanted to ask you, do you actually have a little bit of a perspective? Armenians have the Ararat. The Ararat has a, so to say, it's a real symbol. It's not the land. I would say it is part of the Armenian heart, if that is a good analogy. But for the Azeris, what does Karabakh mean? Is it just we were given this land some time ago by Stalin, so that's why we need it? Or does it have any sentimental connection at all, other than the brainwashing system by Mr. Ilham Aliyev?
Well, it's hard for me to say. Most Armenians would, of course, say, "Oh, it's all brainwashing." But I don't think it's that simple. I think we as Armenians, my compatriots are not going to like me saying this, especially now that there's such a rally on the block. But I'll be an intellectual and true to myself in this. I think we Armenians have to understand that we have a very deep connection to the land. Some of them have a connection to the land as well. And again, I actually learned it from the American Indians, because they say, we understand that the whites over the past 300 years have developed a connection. Mm-hmm. We're glad for you that you have that connection. But please recognize that our roots go thousands of years, while yours is only 300 years old. And I think we have to have that narrative with the Azerbaijanis. Dismissing it is not helpful. At some point, some Azerbaijani, Turkic Azerbaijani people did live in those villages. And they did live in Shushi, and they did live in some of these places. And just dismissing it like, is not going to help us. It's not going to help us. So, yes, there are refugees who remember how they used to live in those places. And they told that to their children. Why can't we, I think we have to speak from a position of confidence and accept that yes, most people in Nagorno-Karabakh were of the Armenian origin, and some were of the Azerbaijani origin. And we have a deep spiritual connection to our land. But some people, are relative newcomers, but they have developed those connections as well. Why can't we acknowledge that? I think that needs to be, if ever there is a reconciliation process, that needs to be part of the story. And what are we so afraid of? Suppose 20% of the Nagorno-Karabakh will be the Azerbaijani people. I know what I am afraid of. Mm-hmm. If they return now, there will be more tension. That's what I'm afraid of. People will fight. They will look at each other, point fingers at these people. These people will be discriminated against. They will be harassed. So, but at some point in some distant future, why can't we have a vision of saying, all right, okay. And that is a long and difficult reconciliation, truth speaking kind of process that will hopefully have to emerge at some point. Apart from that, I wouldn't be able to say. I wouldn't be able to say if there's some strong symbolism, the way Ararat is a symbol meaning for us. Maybe there is. Maybe they have places and mountains and locations. I know there is a lot of talk of Ardam, and that's heartbreaking because I have seen Ardam. It doesn't exist. It's a town in Nagorno-Karabakh that was populated by Azerbaijanis. And they talk about returning there. It has been razed to the ground. It looks like a surreal place. And you cannot go there because it's still there's still lots of mines. Mm-hmm. It's unsafe to walk there. But you can see it from the road. And it looks like a massive ruin where not a single wall is above 1 meter high. So, when Azerbaijanis, in Azerbaijan, the refugees, people from Ardam, when they talk about returning to them, the town, I wonder if they know what they're talking about. Maybe they want to come back and rebuild that. I don't know. But at the moment, it's a minefield of ruins. That's what I've done is it doesn't exist. And it is sad. It's a loss. But yeah, so it would be interesting to have a reasonable Azerbaijani to talk about.
I think
what does Karabakh mean for them? Is it just like a loss and they feel like they've been beaten so they have to take it back? Or is there a symbolic strength and a connection?
And I mean, this understanding is critically important if we talk about conflict resolution, or I would say even mediation is the better word to use here. What do you see? We now looked at the worst perspective from the Armenians. We looked at different perspectives, maybe in Azerbaijan, that may exist. We looked at different rationales. What can we do? Because right now, fact is, human beings, fellow Armenians, and Azeris are losing their lives. We are fighting a senseless war that hurts both countries, their development, their future, their capacity for peace and prosperity. So it should be in both parties' interest to find an agreement that is non-violent and non-threatening. What do you think? Who can intervene? What needs to happen? What can Armenian leadership do? What should I know that, for example, Mr. Lavrov invited both the Armenian and the other Azeri leadership to come to Moscow and host talks. Do you think that is just a floskel, or is it an actual option that should be considered? And we would very much love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I think it is an option that should be considered. I mean, at some point, yeah, they'll get to a point then both sides will decide that fighting's enough. It's kind of sad and interesting that we're talking about it now. Just a couple of days ago, we were trying to apply rational choice theory with my graduate students for the Karabakh conflict. And we ended up seeing that the protracted conflict is the equilibrium, given the current preferences, which is scary. You know, I don't want to believe this. I don't want to believe this. But there is a reason why I brought American Indians. You know, I don't know. I don't know what we have to do to make Azerbaijan understand that Karabakh will not be part of Azerbaijani state. It will not. It will, you know, again, I was kind of reading up a little bit about these stories. I heard them from the Indians. It's the Apache Leap story. And Wikipedia says it's a myth. It's not a myth. It's a reality. When a group of Apaches were surrounded on a cliff in Arizona, they jumped off the cliff to their death. But they didn't surrender. You know, it's so hard to explain. But after the first Karabakh War, 1992-1994, back then we didn't know so much about it. And then years later, my brother took his military service in Stepanakert. And he was working for the military, but he was not like a soldier with a gun. He was a computer specialist. So his service was in the form of helping the ministry. And we went to visit him because it was allowed. He was not, as I said, he was living like other soldiers. That entire unit has a bit of a privilege had at the time. We went to visit and we talked to him. This is when we first realized and some things. And he told us back then, he said, in every single family in Karabakh, someone died in a war. In every single family. And what you have in Armenia now, because we're so much more social network connected, mm-hmm. I have a feeling every single family is impacted. In my, I teach free classes. In one of my classes, there is a student who is right now in Stepanakert being shelled, and another student, her brother is in the front line. In my other class, there is a student who is a war journalist, he's in the front line. In my third class, another student voluntarily went to the front lines, and yesterday we got the first news that an AUA student was killed in combat. So my entire community is impacted. And it's tragic, of course, but that makes it worse. That makes it deeper. And so these people will never heal. They will, Artsakh cannot become part of Azerbaijan. They will leap off the cliff. They will kill themselves in battle, but they will not accept Azerbaijan rule. Maybe 100 years, I can't imagine that. No one can imagine that. So that leaves us with a very strong international community norm of territorial integrity, which no state wants to compromise because most states have secession movements and self-determination movements, and they're worried about those. So How do we convince Azerbaijan to let go? Armenian hope was that we grab these buffer territories, and maybe now in this war, we grab even more territories, and then we use them as bargaining chips, saying, okay, we'll give you back those lands, and you recognize Artsakh's independence. But I don't, you know, I understand that this would be a very, very big loss for the Azerbaijani state. There will be a loss of faith. There will be a loss of a substantial chunk of land. And this is not something international community is too excited to see. You know, they don't like those self-determination movements and these little self-proclaimed states becoming, because then, you know, what happens with Catalonia? What happens with the Scottish independent movement? What happens with my beloved Native Americans who want to have their own lands and their own republics and their own states? What happens to all of these movements? Maybe European Union is a little bit of a hope, you know, when you let people divide and then you let them come together again. So maybe 200 years from now, we let it be. We let Artsakh become independent. 100 years pass, people calm down, and then Armenians, Artsakhis, and Azerbaijanis, and maybe Georgians, and Ossetians, and Abkhazians. We also have our neighbors with the same problem, right? Georgians don't want Ossetians and Abkhazians. Absolutely not. Maybe that's what we, but I actually kind of believe in that. I believe that an international community has to take a very deep breath and let go of this concept. Let go of these territorial integrity concept and allow these regions to break up, and then 50 years down the road, they would logically think, oh, wait a second, is it better to be together? I mean, your country, Germany, I think is the example. There are all these German kingdoms, right? All these little things. And at some point they said, hey, together is better. Let's just together. So maybe, but I don't know what it will take for the international community to have that courage. But that would, I think, substantially reduce conflicts on the entire planet. People want independence, give it to them, but let it be.
So again, you brought up a number of very valid points. One observation that I quite liked, the potential strategy of if Armenia may capture more land, this would, negotiation theory would describe it as the best alternative to the negotiated agreement, because before the like after 1994, the negotiated agreement, so to speak, was Karabakh ceasefire, line of contact. And if they give then back the territory which was captured, it would be then the best alternative, and Karabakh would be again whole. One thing you really like made me think about one or two more times was the Karabakh people. The Karabakh people would fight until their death, but they would not leave. So I equate this to the sense of freedom. And there was a very interesting story in the German legal code, which essentially says if a prisoner escapes from prison, he cannot be punished. His prison sentence cannot be extended, because in humans, there is a need, there's an urge to escape. The human is not meant to be confined. And so I think this is a great analogy describing the Karabakh's urge for freedom. Yeah. And I would like to dwell a little bit on the international community. I think, even though not many people know it, but in my effort to look through some archives on the genocide in 1915, I read up the thesis of Mr. Toynbee, and in which he quite illuminated actually that the Germans had their significant part in the Armenian genocide. Not that they perpetrated it, but they would have been able to prevent it. They would have been able to say to the Ottoman Empire, nope, you will not do this. Because they, so to speak, succeeded over them. Which makes me think, right now, Germany is in a very delicate position. It would never intervene militarily. But what could the international community, including, for example, Germany, do to intervene diplomatically or politically or like in their foreign ministry? What would you wish for these nations to do to help in the conflict?
Yeah, I have one very specific wish. I just don't know if they can do it, but I think they should. I think they should have the courage to stop doing these diplomatic, you know, we call on both sides to stop the conflict. And you know what? Yes, if the first sentence was, we condemn Azerbaijan's attack and call on both parties to stop, I would find that reasonable. But by now, we are so fed up of these. I think Armenians get insulted when in situations like that when we equate the two sides. And this is, for crying out loud, 21st century. Now, I would never believe that there is not enough information from all these satellites that are constantly photographing planet Earth to determine who really started it, right? So if they need time to investigate, okay. If they need evidence, okay. If they need to send their experts, okay. But I think the international community has to take this very seriously. Truth speaking, you know, we all lament the post-truth society, blah, blah, blah. I think truth speaking starts with the government. It, as democratic citizens, we expect that, you know, and we should expect that. This is kind of deteriorated. But I want to see international, you know, at least those states who want to be taken seriously by Armenians. I'm not saying side with us, we're right. I'm saying investigate. Get your, you know, data, whatever you want, and then say, yes, according to international reports, this and this happened, and we condemn Azerbaijan's. I think that would be sending a signal. Something like that a little bit happened when they said, you know, foreign mercenaries need to be taken out of the country. I think that was a little bit of a, you know, telling Turkey, you can't do this, we're watching you. But so far, whatever they do, they get away with it, you know. Whoever, if it's Armenians who attack, okay. Okay, then tell you Armenians, you attacked them. Mm-hmm. You started it, it's your fault. But I think we have to start speaking with facts, and truth-telling is important. And that would at least be a start and a signal. And, you know, call things what they are.
So what is very interesting in what you said, because I'm in command of the German language, so I also read some German language news on the conflict. And the wording that they use there is very interesting. So they say Separatistenregion, which more or less loosely translates to separatist region. And you always associate, okay, separatists that are these crazy extremists, they have like weird wishes, like we don't really support that. So it already, even though it's supposedly neutral, has a very negative connotation. And I think, like, just look at it. Europe was very religiously and ethnically divided. So Spain had its own history, Switzerland, etc., and other countries. However, the former Soviet Union, borders were drawn very arbitrarily, not in the context of their like their nations. So quite frankly, European leader countries are unable, don't have the ability to introspect how it is to be a leadership in a country where you don't really represent the people from a historical perspective.
Yeah, language matters, and it creates those associations. So yeah, that's one thing. I don't know what else could you know, international community, could they pressure? And I also don't believe in it. Yeah? I don't believe in international pressure. If Azerbaijan is to democratize with European aid, that could jeopardize the project from the start. It needs to be genuine. It needs to be local. Once it happens, like in Armenia, then you can step in and help. But the drive has to be from the inside. For example, yes, and like, so I honestly don't know how international pressure, whether that helps. Maybe with the South African apartheid regime, I think we have a good example. Mm-hmm. But there are so many opposite examples. You try to put pressure, you only result in more rally around the flag kind of phenomenon in the country itself. So, I don't know. I think Armenians don't really hope for anything. I think we know that we have to defend ourselves and we'll do that.
And I mean, money, as we can see in the example of Iran, doesn't really deter the urges of a country, because if it's more authoritarianly dictated, you can always force people to war and to do X without necessarily paying them.
So, it's pretty... I wish I had a solution. You know, I wish I could say, oh yeah, the international community should do ABC. For me, truth speaking would be a good start.
And so I have one very interesting question. Yesterday we dwelt a lot, like highlighting that there's no such thing as monocausality in international relations. So I was asking, what do you see the role of civil society and government? In Armenia specifically, do they play? Can they only win if they work together? Does civil society have a big stake in the game? I mean, in terms of protests, in terms of projects, in terms of peaceful intervention, or it's really first you have to get the politics right, and then this can be supported by civil society. What are your points on the two factors?
You mean inside Armenia or in terms of this war?
In terms of Armenia, and in terms of the war, obviously.
That's a great question. This was actually my PhD thesis at the time. Oh. Does civil society cause democracy, or does democracy cause civil society?
I like it.
It looks like political institutions are very important. And you get the space which then enables civil society to flourish. But of course, the Velvet Revolution is the example of both, frankly, but also of political institutions, because it wasn't just a civil society, it was a political force. But yeah, it was a very powerful example of how you might think civil society is weak, you might think it's rather small, but it kind of like builds up and learns and tries things out and builds connections. And then there is this window of opportunity and it just kind of flourishes. And 2 weeks later, a dictatorship falls and the democracy is established. So that was, I think that's why we all love this story. At the moment, it's very interesting because we're seeing unbelievable levels of mobilization in terms of volunteer effort. But I've seen this before. I think this is one of the, I told my students in class the other way, I think it's an Armenian know-how that maybe we should be proud of, and I don't know if it can be exported. But in times of crisis, people come together. I've seen that during the 1988 earthquake. I've seen it during the April War. It's remarkable. I mean, the lines in front of the blood donation stations, people stood for 4 or 5 hours to donate blood until they said, please don't come anymore. We can't store any more blood donations. We'll call you if we need it. Same with humanitarian aid. You know, it's unbelievable. It's just what, so in that sense, of course, I would call it civil society. It is what it is. People coming together for a common cause. And they're collecting goods and they're volunteering and they're donating and they're doing all kinds of things. And I think that is why we are unbreakable. Because how do you conquer a nation where every man is ready to die, and when men die, women will start fighting and people are willing to give everything into the war effort? What is strange, of course, is that when it's not a crisis, we could use some of that spirit. Mm-hmm. Somehow, when it's not a crisis, we're not as communal oriented as we could have been, but maybe it will come. Maybe it will develop. So at the moment, it's a nationwide mobilization. not only in terms of military, but also in terms of volunteering and humanitarian.
Then what are your thoughts on the young men that flock to the military recruiting centers right now to support in Karabakh? From my perspective, I have both, like, in a way, a smiling eye and a crying eye, because it may very well likely mean that young people are being killed and hurt and injured, while on the other hand, of course, it shows a strong sense of nationality or patriotism, I think it's the better word, to serve and protect Armenia.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking. I mean, the student that died was an April War veteran. He got injured during the April War. He had signs of honor, medals from the April War, and he volunteered. He went right, he survived one war and did his share and did more than enough. And now he volunteered and he's lost. You know, the other student who volunteered, one of my students, and I hope he's alive and well. We haven't heard much, but we don't expect daily news from him. He just got married, like a week ago. It's mind-boggling. But it is very, very sad. But they feel like they have to do it. They feel like, I know someone who is in his 70s who went to sign up. They told him, go home.
And I think they really should, you know?
Yes.
I love that people care, but I also, as a state, as a military organization, you have the responsibility to protect your personnel.
Yes, absolutely. Of course. I think we're doing a bit better job now than in April War, to be honest. I have a feeling it's a bit more organized, including these volunteers coming and signing up and being, during the April War, there were some paramilitary volunteer units that were getting guns and that was strange. Yeah, I also find it very touchy when, especially in the diaspora, people are like, signing up, we're going to, you know, American Armenians, we're going to go protect Armenians. You've never held a gun in your hands. Stay put. At least these guys that are being conscripted, they have military service experience. Because in Armenia, every man has to have a military service experience. So these people had their share. They had 2 years of military service, some in more peaceful times, some in less peaceful times. At least they know what they're doing, you know. They know how to load a gun. They know how to protect themselves. I have another student in my class who was an April War veteran. On Monday, when we were having the discussion, of course, we're not having classes like nothing happened. We're talking about this. And he said this, I'm quoting him, you have to be wise and you have to be careful. So patriotism is great, but you have to be wise and careful. And yes, let's hope that they are as protected as they can be. Seeing what kind of military is engaged, you know, the death toll is high, but yes, it's tragic. It is very tragic. But yeah, I think these young men think, if not me, then who? We're all like saying, we're with our soldiers, we pray for them. And yesterday on the Armenian news was giving like short bits from these guys, 20-year-old guys on the front lines. And one of them said, don't be afraid. Like he's talking to us, you know, people in civilians. He said, don't be afraid, you're not alone, we are here. I was like,
And I mean, especially when you're younger, oftentimes your prefrontal cortex is not entirely able to evaluate danger appropriately. And that makes it really hard rendering. But you talked a little bit about the diaspora's response, and maybe if I want to and dwell on this for 1 or 2 minutes. So there's the hashtag floating Artsakh Strong on Facebook, Instagram, etc. So which are pushing Armenia, which are potentially flying to Armenia and wanting to help. What would you recommend them? How can they help? How can they become involved? What can they do? International, yeah. Not based in Armenia.
Yeah, I know that it's actually really hard to just sit there on your hands and thinking, what can I do? We had to calm a lot of students at the UAB because they wanted to do something. Mm-hmm. As a political scientist, we are a society that has an X amount of resources and the governance structures. And at times like this, it's paramount that we use those governance structures, that we don't overload the system. And the Armenian government, for example, with the blood donation, it's not needed at the moment. They will call us, I've signed up, and they will call me when I'm needed. So there's no point standing in line for 4 hours. There's absolutely no point. Humanitarian donation needs to go to the government. Yeah, don't get into your car and drive to Artsakh and dump it somewhere. It's a hotbed for corruption. So the government Ministry of Defense has several, I think, phone numbers. I saw it on TV yesterday. So first, follow only the official news, only, explicit. Second, try to use these channels to see what is needed. Do they need more food, or do they need sleeping bags, or do they need medicine? And we've got, for example, the way we did it at AUA, we held the students back, said, wait, until my dear colleague and an incredibly committed, hardworking person, she got hold of someone at the Ministry of Defense and got a list of what it needed. And by now, the Ministry of Defense already said, we don't need anything else at the moment, because we're overloading the system. Another example that I remember, someone really wants to call me. So during the 1988 earthquake, many Armenians jumped on their private cars and drove towards the earthquake zone. As a result, the roads were blocked and the first aid cars couldn't get through. So we don't want that. Now we want to do what the government tells us is needed now. The easiest thing is, of course, financial donations. And there are the All Armenian Fund. They have you could send a donation there. You could buy some medicine, especially first aid kind of stuff, keep it in your house and send it when it's needed. There are some organizations that ship things for free for Armenia already, so those kinds of things. What I also know is, it depends on your profession, right? But I think people with experience with conflicts, kind of psychology, might want to start forming groups. And for example, in my university, we're talking about creating a task force to support students affected by war, but we are stretched so thin. So if there are specialists on standby that we can refer to, a student who has lost a relative, and it doesn't have just to be us.
And I mean, the great thing, if I can, sorry, briefly interrupt, and we will help you in this regard by putting a call out. You don't need to be in Armenia. You can be in Australia, America, anywhere. We have technology, Zoom, Skype, whatever, you name it. So again, to whoever hears it right now, if you are a psychologist, if you know someone who has a relevant experience in this domain, reach out to us and we will connect you. And I think this is a very timely task.
Yeah, and the most important thing is, of course, support each other. Yeah, support, if you know someone in Armenia, send them an SMS, say we love you, we're with you. It's just those human, it's very taxing right now in Armenia. It's psychologically very, very taxing. So, whatever, a warm hug or something like that. And stay tuned. Hopefully we'll hear the good news any day that it's a ceasefire, but somehow I'm not optimistic. And that means, yes, humanitarian aid will be needed. And even more importantly, when this ends, we've got work to do. We've got houses to rebuild. We've got, people to take care of. It's that willingness to help, it needs to be spread a little bit. Now, we don't want to everybody jumps onto something now and then a week down the road. So keep that desire to help and be on standby and be ready to help. And there's plenty of work for sure.
So we have covered now quite a lot of perspectives and gained a lot of ground and understanding. So I think it's appropriate to turn to the final part of the interview. And here we would like to understand really what are your perspectives of the long-term consequences and implications of the war to Armenia, its partners, and the world at large. And I would like you to take the consideration that, okay, there's a sort of a ceasefire and we have sort of a status quo, non-violent. But then 5 years down the road, how will others react? How does it impact the Armenian psyche? How does it impact like the willingness of partners to collaborate? And we already touched on a number of other semi-independent regions across the world. How will this impact them, for example? And again, like just let your thoughts free run.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot depends on how this ends, right? Does it end with a return to status quo? Does it end with military gains for Armenia? Does it end with military losses for Armenia? Whatever little hope we had of peaceful relationships with Azerbaijan, it has gotten even harder. Mm-hmm. It has gotten, now you get a whole new wave of, you know, not just 20 years old, I think 10, 15 years old, kids, anyone who realizes what's happening, now you've lost that generation as well for the peaceful kind of conversations of we need to be civil, we need to be, you know. Yeah, that's the sad thing, but it's true. I'm afraid that the hate towards Azerbaijanis and Turks has gone one step up and no one benefits from that, no one. Except maybe the soldiers who need that now to get them through. But I found out that people actually have been in military conflict are the ones that actually don't talk about hate and they don't talk about killing. They've got their share of killing and they, but it's the people who are like, you know, Facebook warriors who are like, oh. And there's plenty of Facebook warriors, unfortunately. So yeah, that is the indirect cost of it. Yeah, we have moved one step away from civil neighborly relations. We were pretty far already, but you know, whatever hopes we had that Turkey could be reasonable and we might have some reconciliation there have been dashed. So I don't think anyone in Armenia believes that any reconciliation is forthcoming anytime soon. Yeah, the hope of the Armenian leadership is, as I said, that we caused so much damage to the Azerbaijani side that we can then negotiate a better deal for Artsakh. It's already being talked about. Armenia has, until now, has not recognized Artsakh's independence, but there are talks about that now, that we will recognize independence and we'll sign an agreement with them and a conversation whether they want to be independent and part of Armenia. Will we start? I don't know if that's going to happen. And I don't know how that's going to ripple for the world. I think, as you said, you know, it's a separatist region and we're going to be maybe equated with Russia annexing Crimea. I don't know. It's not good for the world, but it's not good for our image, but Armenians don't seem to care. And I don't care also. That's again, yeah, we've gotten to that point. But we don't really care about anyone out there. All we care is, you know, our own people. So, yeah, you've lost a whole generation that was believing that international community would side with us and that there is a justice out there. These, you know, that disappointment is settling in. I've seen, read, heard students saying, I used to believe in these peace camps and talking and I don't believe. So that's a big loss for international community, I think. They've lost one more shade of credibility in this part of the world. Partners, it depends on how partners behave. Yeah, so far Armenia has not asked for help. So, but if it does ask for help and it doesn't get the help, you know, that's not cool either. whoever stands by Armenia, of course, is going to massively gain popularity in Armenia right now. So, you know, if any state or organization, everybody's already talking about Cyprus, how Cyprus is on our side, because they made a pretty clear statement on that. What's the implication for the world? Nothing good, I'm afraid. Again, for me, of course, I want the Artsakh independence, or even their, maybe if they want to be united with Armenia, that should be their decision. But for the world, the message would be, oh, look, Armenians had a military victory. Suppose we have it. And they got their way. So that's the way to solve it, right? That's not a message. That is not the message. You know, that's a scary message. The only good thing I can hope for is that, you know, if Azerbaijan does not succeed, and I believe it will not succeed, that might be the message. We'll need to work on that being the message. You can't resolve conflicts through restarting the war, because that's, it should have never started. The negotiations should have continued for the Minsk group or from some other point. Now they have started a war, and you know, and they're not going to succeed. So I don't know. It's kind of, maybe it's because it's so grim, and I mean, you know, I'm kind of not very optimistic for the world. I think the world has become more, I don't know if it has become more cynical, or it was always cynical, but for a period, you know, after the Soviet Union collapsed, there seemed to be a better mood of like more optimism, more belief in international organizations, less realpolitik. And I think we're getting right back to realpolitik, unfortunately.
So if I may offer my personal perspectives, I mean, the Cold War really defined a bipolar world order where, like, you were subdued, like, if you weren't belonging to the power, you had to choose its side. But they broke. Then China, like, gained tremendously on economic power, leeway, especially also with their Belt and Road Initiative. But what we can really describe, there is no one power now. We are in a multipolar world order. And now in this new multipolar world order, every country, every region needs to find their own identity. How can they coexist, exclamation mark, peacefully in a global context? And I think over the next few years, or ever since, I think it takes about 50 years. So the Cold War ended 1989. And so we will have about another 20 more years where countries need to find and test what do they want. And only when this process ends, you will find sustained peace and prosperity again. But sort of what is happening now in Nagorno-Karabakh and other regions across the world, maybe described, I'm happy to hear your thoughts on this, as a process of identity finding and protecting. Yeah.
Maybe. But the only thing that I kind of particularly focused on from what you said is that during the Cold War, you know, if you were small, you were subdued. I think Armenia's message in this situation is you can't subdue us. You may destroy us, but you want no colonialism, never again. We're done, you know. We've had our share of foreign powers subduing us and integrating us into their structures. And we have won our independence for a very high price. The people of Artsakh won their independence with a very high price. We're not going back. We're no longer. And so if we perish in this process, then we perish. But we're not going to be part of another big game. And we're not bowing to anyone any longer. We might want to negotiate and balance and complementarity and whatnot. But yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. It's the attempt to subdue the people, and it's people resisting, right? You can say, no, we fight for our freedom, for our right to live on our land, the way we want.
Very powerful words. Could you then, if you have one, like, It's just like a statement of courage, maybe, and addressed two parties. One, Armenians, your fellow compatriots, and second, global civil society who are not Armenian. Because I'm a strong believer that, government does what it wants all over the world, but people all over the world, they have a common denominator. And if people pair up, they are able to achieve unforeseen. And my goal is always to get non-Armenians care for Armenia, to get non-Armenians to become aware of Armenia and to support any way they can. And yeah, if you have a comment to both of these parties.
Yeah, I think to my Armenian friends and relatives and relatives in a broad sense, right? We're all humans are relatives. We're all relatives. So, I would say, let's please, it's hard not to hate. It's easy to give in into this bitterness and anger, and let's please try not to forget that we're human beings and we're compassionate. And it's remarkable that on Sunday morning, when Artsakh was attacked, and when the Artsakh president was talking about the Genatz Mahut Paperazm, the war of life or death, he also found that minute to add, please, it's not about Azerbaijani citizens. Please don't target them. As in, not military target, but you have to war, you have to fight. But in terms of, like, you know, especially in the diaspora, you might be living side by side. It's not them. It's not their fault. Don't give in into hate. Don't give in into anger. Let's please not demonize because that's what happened. They demonize the other, and that's how they, you know, do the ugly things they do. Yeah, we're not that. This is not our way. Humanitarian, human rights, fair warfare, this is our way. Yeah, we don't do this. So let's please try to resist them. And I know we can, I know we're generous, because we ourselves have been dehumanized and subjected to all kinds of ugly things. And we're not that. That's how we define our difference and our right to be called an ancient nation and part of a civilized world. For the international community, what I find heartbreaking is, you want to say something?
Yeah, it's civil society.
Civil society.
So not,
yes.
So not any organization.
Civil society, yes, yeah. Yes.
International civil society community, so to speak.
Yes. What I find heartbreaking is conflicts disappear from people's radars very quickly. I mean, think about the Syria, think about Yemen, think about all these other places. And we are very blessed to have the diaspora and to have the visibility in the world and I'm not even saying don't forget Armenians. Don't forget people who suffer. Join the humanitarian Aurora Initiative. I am not working for Aurora. I just love them. I think they're so great. You don't have to help Armenians. You can help someone next door to you. But there seems to be these like, oh, there is, you know, war happening somewhere, and then 1 week down the road, it's not even. I don't know how, but we have to learn to sustain our focus on the suffering, on the human suffering, and help them, even when it's not on the news, even when the world has moved on. I don't know. I mean, it is upsetting that you turn on the BBC and it's Trump, Biden, Earth campaign, and then Brexit, and then this and that, and, you know, the COVID is still raging. It's still ripping through the world and Armenia. And no one even talks about COVID anymore because everybody talks about war. Yeah, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I think what I'm trying to say is the same. Let's try to be more human and don't forget. Don't forget. Don't let those stupid news grab your attention. Focus on what matters. Human life matters. Yeah, yeah, somehow we have to heal the world. It's too divisive at the moment. It's so toxic everywhere. Everywhere you look, it's the same populist rubbish. Don't know. And yeah, when it's over, come visit Armenia. It will be over. We're very happy when people come. They're very hospitable.
Very powerful words from Jenny Paturian. We were really blessed to have you here, and I think everybody benefited from your thoughtful, analytical perspectives, and also like a modicum of personality of the personal subjective experience, but it's also very important to better understand the conflict, its implications, and so to speak, the future. So I can only say thank you very much for having you and for joining us today. And let us know if you have any concluding remarks, if you want to greet any friends and family, or share any last thoughts.
No, I think I just want to thank you for this very interesting and long conversation. And I want to wish peace, obviously, to everyone. Yes, our war is scaring us and getting us worried sick, but I don't even know how many conflicts rage on this planet right now. I think a lot. And that's just it's not right. It can't be right. Regardless of who wins in the end, it just can't be right. Yeah. Peace and patience and humanity.